Remember the book of Revelation? We stopped around the end of chapter 7. We're going to launch into chapter 8, and chapter 8 is where the Lord begins to do some exciting things in terms of man's future history here on earth. And we felt it was important to set the stage for what's going to be taking place within the nation of Israel, what has and will be taking place. But more importantly than that, once you move from Revelation 8 onward, it becomes rather important to establish whether or not these portions of the book of Revelation are meant to be taken literally. And one reason we're taking this sojourn into mainly the Old Testament, what it has to say about Israel in the last days, is to see that the rule of thumb that we've been using to take the scriptures literally unless the context demands otherwise is a valid way of interpreting scripture. And that's what we're doing with these verses concerning prophecy and modern Israel, is to see how specifically and precisely these predictions made thousands of years ago apply literally to the literal Jews in the land of Israel in these last days. And I think you get a greater confidence for why we're taking that rule of thumb for interpreting the book of Revelation, because we can see that it really works in terms of what else the Bible has to say concerning the end times. I mean, there are those that say, well, all of these dooms prophesied in Revelation 6, 8, and 16 really are not meant to be taken literally, but to be taken figuratively. But this is similar to saying that all these prophecies that refer to the Jews and modern Israel actually refer to Christians in the church throughout all church ages and have got nothing to do with what's taking place today. But that can be countered by going through some of the scriptures and seeing that it's too specifically fulfilled to be a mere human coincidence. And I'm hoping as we work our way through this, you can see that this is no mere coincidence. This is actually the fulfillment of God's word. And it's in line with what God says in Ezekiel. I got a little verse down the bottom. Not for the sake of Israel. Ezekiel 36, 22 to 32, Isaiah 19, and Deuteronomy 9, 6. Where we have three specific prophecies where God explains why he's going to be doing these miracles in the last days amongst the Jews in the land of Israel. It says it's to convince the peoples of the world that God is taking action to wrap up human history, is to get their attention. And therefore, he's going to fulfill these prophecies in such a way that no one can say, well, this is just human history, God's got nothing to do with it. It's a mere accident that it seems to line up with biblical prophecy. God says, no, I'm going to be doing amazing things in front of your very eyes as a fulfillment of my predicted word. We're going to get into some of that today as we look at the developments in the new nation Israel. I do want to thank those of you who led the group while I was in Africa through the second rebirth of Israel as a nation. Thank you for taking the class through those scriptures. Some exciting verses right there about the specific details of how Israel was formed. The book of Ezekiel, recall that, where the vision of Valley of Dry Bones, where the nations of the world see huge valleys filled with the skeletons of dead Jews, then they will say the Jews as a people, as a nation, are finished and will never rise again. And yet a year later, that's when the nation was reborn in exact fulfillment of prophecy in the book of Ezekiel. The new nation Israel. Let's begin with the first passage, Isaiah 11. Verses 11 through 16. What I'm going to do is kind of summarize some of the less important passages and actually read some of the more specific passages, the more dramatic passages. Starting off in Isaiah 11, 11 through 16, we have these predictive statements in that passage. First, it says that Israel, in its formation, its rebirth as a nation, will conquer Philistia first, then eastern Palestine, and then Jordan. In fact, as we go through the book of Isaiah, it outlines the process by which the land of Israel will be settled by Jews and how the land will expand. Now, this is a map circa 1946 for Jewish settlement. But if you go back to the very first Jewish settlement of the return of the Jews to the land of Israel, it began in Petah Tikva, right in the middle of the Philistine plain. I mean, this area right in here is called the Philistine plain. And that's what it says here in Isaiah 11, that Israel will take over the Philistine area, the Philistine territory first. And starting in 1885, this was the region of the settlement by the Jews returning from all the nations in the world. They settled here first, and then, as our passage points out, the second region of settlement was eastern Galilee, in this area here. In the 1920s and 30s, they began to settle here. And then they began to settle in Jerusalem and the Negev. And here are the Negev settlements and Jerusalem. And by 1946, this is the region that had at least 50% Jews or more. And this area was settled predominantly by those Jews that returned to the land of Israel. Now, the passage goes on to say a few other things. First, it says that during this time of resettlement of the Jews from all the nations of the world, something unique will happen. The Jews will not be divided. They will be united. It says, no longer will the north be in opposition to the south. No longer will Judah be in opposition to Ephraim. They'll be united. If you read back in Jewish history, that certainly wasn't the case with the Jews. I mean, he used to tell jokes about the Jews before this time. You put three Jews in one room and you get four political parties. Put three Jews in one room, you got five conflicting opinions. And the Jews have had a history of dividing and fighting one another. But this particular prophecy, Isaiah 11:11-16, says this will change. Moreover, there's a prediction that not only will the Jews returning from the nations of the world settle in the land of Israel, it says, quite pointedly, that they will take control over the area on the other side of the Jordan, the area of Ammon, the territory of the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites. And this would be this region that was called Transjordan before 1948 and the territory of Jordan afterwards. As we go through these scriptures, it's interesting how many times it refers to the Jewish relationship with the land of the Ammonites, the Edomites, and the Moabites. Now, what I find ironic is back in 1919, incidentally, do you gentlemen want to make an announcement in the class? Okay, sorry. If you did, I was going to give you that opportunity. In 1919, Winston Churchill made the boast that he created the territory of Transjordan with a stroke of a pen. Now, that's the only time in modern history that we've had a nation that perfectly and only encompassed the territories of the ancient kingdoms of Ammon, Moab, and Edom. So God was behind Winston Churchill's stroke of the pen, controlling his stroke of the pen to create a country which would contain and only contain these nations we see mentioned repeatedly in the prophecies concerning the return of the Jews to the land of Israel. But this is something that's not yet fulfilled. People say, what's going to happen next in Israel? Well, one thing we see repeated six times throughout the Old Testament is that these Jews returning to the land of Israel must gain some kind of control over the land of Jordan. Maybe that will be the ultimate solution to the Palestinian problem, that the Israelis may take advantage of some political situation, maybe the passing of King Hussein, and set up Jordan as a Palestinian state. And that's basically the comment of the Likud party today, is that Israel, this side of the Jordan, is the Jewish state. The territory on the other side of the Jordan, that's the Palestine of the Old Testament. They say that's the Palestinian state. We'll make that a Palestinian state and this a Jewish state. There is no mention in any of these six passages that this will take place through the shedding of blood. Now, it could. It's not ruled out. But it could simply be a political coup of some kind where Israel gains control over this territory. Has not yet been fulfilled, but the ultimate coming together of what we see in Revelation 8 and 16 cannot take place until Israel gains some kind of control over Jordan. So that's why we took a break between chapters 7 and 8. There are certain events that must take place in the land of Israel before we can see the unfolding of the events of Revelation chapter 8. The Jews consider that to be part of Israel. They, you know, all their plans in terms of converting Jordan into a Palestinian state would not include the Golan Heights. They would see that as part of their territory. And historically, they made the point that in the days of David and Solomon, the Jews had control of both sides of the Jordan. So they just think they're being generous. Say, we're going to give the Palestinians that which really belongs to us, namely the land of Jordan. So we'll be happy with just this side of the Jordan. Well, hang with me. I think we're going to see a basis for what you're saying of why the Likud party is gaining strength within Israel. I think you made the point quite clear. The Labor Party is completely secular. The Likud party is less so. Their leaders quote some of these very things, these very scriptures that we're going to be going over. They love to quote the last verse of the book of Amos to the effect that when the Jews return to the land for a second time, they'll retain the land from that point in perpetuity. It says, we're never going to give it up. The Bible claims that we'll never have to. And we believe the Bible. So here you've got the prime ministers, both the previous Likud prime minister and the present Likud prime minister, quoting the last few verses of the book of Amos, saying, this is ours. We're not going to give it up. And that's their basis for saying the Judean hills are included. We're not going to give up the West Bank because God has given it to us, according to the book of Amos, to hold from this time onward. And he was the prime minister that passed a law that 20% of the public education time had to be spent in the study of the Old Testament. So, and we're going to read a scripture verse that actually points that out, how that will happen. Now, that really is an amazing prediction because Jews throughout the last couple hundred years have been very secular, really opting for none of this in the public education system. Let's move on. A few other things that are in this passage, yet not yet fulfilled, is how God will dry up the Gulf of Suez and break up the Euphrates River into seven independent streams to permit Jews, the last remnants of the Jews, to come back into the land of Israel. I mean, there are many Jews. Most of the Jews in the world today are living outside of Israel, in spite of the fact we have so many in the land of Israel itself. But in this passage, Isaiah 11:11-16, there are two predictions that the Gulf of Suez within Egypt will be dried up and the Euphrates River will be broken up into seven streams to permit the transfer of Jews from other nations into the land of Israel. This is not without some basis for possible fulfillment. Thanks to the Soviets, there's been two huge dams, the Aswan Dam in Egypt and a dam that I've forgotten the name of on the Euphrates River in the land of Iraq. American engineers were opposed to the construction of both dams because of the enormous silting problems. And the worst prediction by these American engineers were to the effect that the Aswan Dam will silt up and transfer water from the Nile into the desert underground will be unavailable. So you'll actually have less water for irrigation rather than more water. And moreover, it will cause, literally a drying up of the Nile Delta lands. And so that would fill in with the prediction about the Suez area. And the same thing has been predicted by American engineers concerning the dam the Soviets have now built on the Euphrates River. Well, the same consequence of silting up and transferring water into the deserts and drying up the Euphrates River. So that may be one way it will be fulfilled, this prediction will be fulfilled. These engineers are predicting that somewhere after the year 2000, soon after the year 2000, these consequences should be felt. The Jews at one time, you remember during that 73 war? Jews had a plan to blow up the Aswan Dam, but they decided not to do it because they felt it would do more harm to Egypt to leave the dam intact than to blow it up. Interesting comment. Isaiah 19, let me read you this passage. Verse 16, talking about the day when the Jews will return from all the nations of the world, it says, in that day the Egyptians will be like women. They will shudder with fear at the uplifted hand the Lord Almighty raises against them. And the land of Judah will bring terror to the Egyptians. Everyone to whom Judah is mentioned will be terrified because of what the Lord Almighty is planning against them. I'm going to bring a book with me next week that documents some of this terror that has taken place in the five wars that Egypt has fought with Israel, starting in 48 on up into late 1970s, when they fought the attrition war. But from the 67 war, I'll tell you just this one case. There was this tank brigade fighting in the 67 war, an Egyptian tank brigade, and they'd settled down for the night. In the middle of the night, they heard sounds, which they assumed was an invading Israeli tank division. At the sounds, they all abandoned their tanks, in some cases left the tank engines running, and fled on foot without their weapons across the desert in the middle of the night. I mean, that's a foolish thing to do anyway, to flee across the desert. They left water behind. The Israelis the next morning picked these people up. Some of them were very much dehydrated. And then they found all the tanks. And they said, "Why didn't you destroy the tanks?" They said, "Well, we heard these sounds in the middle of the night, and we assumed you were about to get us, so we just got away as fast as we could." And they informed the Egyptians that, "Hey, we were nowhere in the area. We don't know where those sounds came from." But what this passage says, the Lord will terrify them. It says they'll be terrified of the Jews, but the Lord himself will be the one who will terrify them. Now, you can recall back in the books of the Judges where that had happened, where God sent sounds into the midst of invading armies, terrified armies, so that only a few hundred people could take over and conquer that whole army. And in this case, this happened. Incidentally, in that 67 war, those captured Egyptian tanks played a crucial role in one of the battles in the Israeli movement to conquer the Suez. So, you know, here were these tanks left running with all their ammunition intact. And one of the things the Jews did is that they trained their men to run Soviet tanks in the event that they might capture some intact. They were prepared. And here they captured this whole brigade and went on to use those tanks in a critical future battle. Jews will terrify the Egyptians. Incidentally, in the 1973 war, a similar incident was breaking out. And the Egyptians were fleeing their tanks just like they did in 67. But the Egyptian soldiers put a stop to it by machine gunning all the troops that fled. And they put new troops back into the tanks. Can you imagine that? They were so filled with terror that the only way they could stop the terror was to actually kill all the troops that were fleeing and put new troops back into the tanks. So it happened more than once. Isaiah 27:6. This is a more positive passage, and it's not all mayhem we're talking about here. It says, "In days to come, Jacob will take root, Israel will bud and blossom, and fill all the world with fruit." Now, if all you do is travel around the United States, you don't see much Israeli fruit, mainly because of the force of the California Growers Associations. They're quite effective at stopping much foreign fruit from coming into the country. Look at all the fuss we've had about Chilean fruit these last few days. But as you travel outside the United States, literally you see Israeli fruit and all the fruit stands in the nations around the world. And I lived in Canada. There is Israeli fruit sold in all the markets. In Europe, there's Israeli fruit sold in all the markets. Some statistics I can give you here. Israel leads the world in the export of oranges. Not the United States, but Israel leads the world in the export of oranges. And is one of the world leaders in the exports of bananas, tomatoes, and pineapples. You know, that whole area of Galilee, that's 600 feet below sea level, has been converted into banana orchards and pineapple orchards. It's the one area where they've got a tropical region, and they've converted that whole section into the growing of fruit. And yet it's a rather tiny land. How did such a tiny land become such a major exporter of fruit? But there's a prediction here that they would fill all the world with fruit. Isaiah 35, 1-2 is similar. "The desert and the wilderness will bloom." And the Israelis have been world leaders in developing orchards that can survive in 4 inches of rain a year. No one else does it, but they do it. they get orchards growing and trees growing, forests growing in regions that have very little rainfall. Isaiah 32, 12 to 15. An interesting prediction. Have you ever visited the land of Israel and trampled around Jerusalem? How the city of David will be abandoned until the Spirit is poured out upon his people and the deserts become fertile. In other words, when Isaiah 35, that's why I read that passage first, or gave you that passage first, when the deserts bloom, when you see all this fruit being produced in areas that have only 4 inches of rain a year, that's when the city of David will be rediscovered and uncovered. Now, for 2,500 years, the city of David has laid under a pile of rubble. No one has dug it up. It began to be dug up for the first time in 1979. My wife and I visited there in 1980. A few of the storerooms of David were uncovered so that you could look at them. But the rest of it was still untouched. Now almost the entire city of David is exposed. But this is the first time in 2,500 years that it's been seen. And the Israeli archaeologists have exposed the whole thing. The ruins are in beautiful condition. The roofs are missing, but everything else is there. So the city of David once again can be seen and visited like it was in the days of Solomon and David. But I find it a fascinating prediction. It will not be revealed until the desert blooms. Isaiah 41, 11 through 20. Let's take a look at that passage. 41, 11 through 20. I won't read you the whole thing, but let me just pick out a few phrases here. Starting in verse 10. I will strengthen you and help you, says the Lord. All who rage against you will surely be ashamed and disgraced. Those who wage war against you will be as nothing at all. Do not be afraid, O little Israel, for I myself will help you, declares the Lord. See, I'll make you into a threshing sledge, new and sharp with many teeth. Now, that's where it's talking about Israel's ability in dealing with its enemies. I mean, back in 1948, nobody gave the Jews a chance in the land of Israel. They said, you're surrounded by nations who are determined to wipe you out and drive you into the sea that number 120 million. They have 5 organized armies. You have nothing. Yet this passage says, do not be afraid, for I myself will help you. I will make you into a threshing sledge, new and sharp with many teeth. And the 5 wars that Israel has fought against overwhelming odds, they've been able to be successful and victorious. Now, today it is such that Israel militarily ranks as the 4th most powerful nation in the world. That's an incredible achievement for 3.5 million Jews, that they're able to maintain an armed force that ranks 4th in the world, behind the United States, the Soviet Union, and mainland China. They're next. They're ahead of West Germany, for example. They're ahead of Japan. They're ahead of Egypt. They're ahead of Vietnam in terms of its military strength. And yet they're able to maintain a viable economy in the face of having such a huge armed force. Now, in terms of their economy, verse 17 says, the poor and needy search for water, but there is none. Their tongues are parched with thirst. And here it's referring to the land the way it was, a desert. Remember what we read from Mark Twain? You can ride a horse for 30 miles in any direction and see only a single inhabitant, see only a single house. It was desolate. It was parched. No water. It says, I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will make rivers flow on barren heights and springs within the valleys. I will turn the desert into pools of water and the parched ground into springs. I will put in the desert the cedar and the acacia, the myrtle and the olive. I will set pines in the wasteland, the fir and the cypress together, so that the people may see and know, may consider and understand that the land of the Lord, that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created it. I should have brought some of the slides that my wife and I took in our visit to Israel in 1980. So what you see in those 1980 photographs are pine trees on the tops of the Judean hills. And it's easy to see by looking at those pine trees that they're only 13 years old. They were planted after their conquest in 1967. You look at photographs before 1967, the Judean hills, Hebron hills, they were barren. There was nothing on them. little bits of grass here and there, little bits of sage here and there, but that was it. In some cases, not even that. When we visited in 1980, it was all forested. Now, with the reforestation of these highlands by the Jews since 1967, when they took over this land, the rainfall has doubled. There's been a doubling of the rainfall. You know, and climatologists will tell you that will happen if you reforest to that degree. You know, it will change the reflectivity of the area to a sufficient degree that it will engender major climate changes. And the rainfall has literally doubled, in some cases much more than doubled, within this whole region. This is what it says in the passage. The cedar, the acacia, the myrtle, the olive in the desert. The deserts now have trees in them, but they had no trees before. And then the wastelands, these Judean highlands that were barren. Pine trees, fir trees, cypress trees. And that's what we saw in our visit. Pines, firs, and cypress trees on these highlands that they had taken over. Now why? Verse 20 says, I will do this so that the people may see and know, may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created it. Now, we're going to come up with another passage that's very interesting, a prediction to the effect that when God performs these miracles, the Jews will take the credit. But this passage makes it clear. It's not the wisdom of the Jews. It's not the fact that they're so energetic and so wise. God himself is the one who will do it. I mean, they could have planted all these trees and had no effect on the rainfall, and all the trees could have died. But God worked things out. It wasn't just Jewish ingenuity. The hand of the Lord has blessed them. Isaiah 48, verses 3 to 7 and verse 11. This is the passage. It says, the Israelis will resist giving God the credit for his obvious miracles in their land. But God will convince them through his prophetic word. That's the thrust of this passage. That the Jews will be very resistant to give God credit. But in the end, they'll be convinced through his prophetic word. That's one of the purposes of these hundreds of predictions that God has given us in the Old Testament concerning the second return of the Jews to the land of Israel. So that in the end, they'll be convinced that this wasn't their own doing. That God predicted this. As it says in the passage, I'm going to do these things long before they're fulfilled. So when they happen, you will know that I did it, that you yourself did not do it. But it's going to take them time. They're going to resist. And right now, there's a spirit of resistance with a few cracks, Menachem Begin being one, saying, hey, God said we're going to have the land forever. We're not going to give it up. We got no plans to return this to the Palestinians. Isaiah 51, verse 3. The deserts and the wastelands will be like the Garden of Eden. Isaiah 51, 22 to 23, same chapter. It says, God's wrath, and God poured out a lot of wrath on the Jews. I mean, the 6.5 million that got killed by Hitler and probably another 6 million that were killed by Stalin. An example of God's wrath poured upon the Jews who refused to live up to his commands that they be a light to the peoples of the world. He says, that wrath will be transferred from you to your tormentors. Those who torment you will experience my wrath. Isaiah 54, verse 3. You will spread out to the right and to the left. Your descendants will dispossess nations and settle in their desolate cities. And starting in 47, right up through to 73, you can see evidences of the Israelis in their wars taking over the land of the Arabs. The Arabs fleeing, and they resettle in their cities. The first major example of that was the Port of Haifa. The Port of Haifa was an Arab city. But in the battles that took place in late 1947, the Jews were cutting off the land of Haifa, and the thing they said to the Arabs is, don't leave, stay. We want you to join with us in our new venture. Don't leave your homes. But instead, they fled their homes. They abandoned their possessions. And they wouldn't come back. After the war, the Jews again invited them to return. Says, come back. Join with us. But they wouldn't come back. And it was that point when the Jews took over the Port of Haifa, and it's been a Jewish city ever since. It was an Arab city, but it became a Jewish city. And that's been the case. The Jews are now settling in these cities that were abandoned. Isaiah 61, 4 to 5, how non-Jews will work for the Jews. It says, they will rebuild the ancient ruins and restore the places long devastated. They'll renew the ruined cities that have been devastated for generations. Here it's referring to many of the major cities in Philistia. I mean, you can look at a map of Israel today. Ashkelon. Ashkelon has been abandoned for 2,500 years, but it's a Jewish city now. That was one of the major cities of the Philistines. But in the very ruins of Ashkelon, they built a new city. 50,000 people live there now. So the cities that you see mentioned in the Old Testament, Beersheba, 150,000 Jews live there. These ancient cities, long ruined, long devastated, have been restored and renewed. They've been devastated for generations. Then it says, aliens will shepherd your flocks. Foreigners will work your fields and vineyards. 1.5 million Arabs are employed by 3.5 million Jews to do this very thing today. Jeremiah 3, I just mentioned this because of some of the New Age stuff and the films that have come out. Verse 16 says, in those days when your numbers have increased greatly in the land, declares the Lord, men will no longer say the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. It will never enter their minds or be remembered. It will not be missed,